How many of you guys remember from 314 what a mutual fund is? Everybody remember what a mutual fund is? Anybody remember what a mutual fund is? Okay, yeah, a mutual fund, you can invest, you put your money into a fund, they buy you a whole bunch of stocks or bonds or whatever their fund is, you invest your money, you can redeem it for the NAV, put your money in, take your money out, and each time you put money in, they create new units, each time you draw your money out, they subtract new units. So that's a mutual fund. We also talked about ETFs, exchange-traded funds. Well, today we're going to talk about a whole different type of fund. It's called a closed-end fund.
Do you need me to... My batteries are dead.
Okay.
I just checked the laser pointer.
Well, I can stand up here and press the button for you if you want. So a closed-end fund's a whole different beast, a whole different animal.
I should have
really
some.
Really interesting opportunities to take advantage with closed-end funds that you can't get with mutual funds or ETFs. We're lucky to have with us today Mr. John Cole Scott. He and his father run the closed-end fund advisors here in Richmond. It's an asset management firm for mostly high-net-worth individuals. And they specialize in running portfolios of closed-end funds. So I thought, since most of you probably have never heard of a closed-end fund, and we have one of the leading global closed-end fund experts here with us today, you'd enjoy hearing from Mr. Scott. With that,
anybody
I'll turn it over
hold
to
the mouse, would that work?
Mr. Scott. You can do that. I hate to see you. Is it just not clicking at all? Where's your clicker again?
The laser pointer didn't come on, so I suspect it's actually... Anyone have AAA batteries?
Yeah. Tim, my man.
All right, I'm glad he came to class.
I'll give you a couple of bucks for that.
No, I'll give him back to you in the class, I promise. Just two. We'll see if this solves the problem.
I have plenty more in my dorm.
Got your exams graded, they're posted, so if you haven't taken a look at them, go ahead and take a look.
You can keep those, it's fine.
I'm really impressed with how well you guys did on that last exam. Very, very nice work.
Oh, it's doing that thing it did before. It works fine on the screen, and then it looks funny on your projector. All right, we're going to have to go back to the beginning. It looks like it's working. Let me find a good spot. I'll probably stand here if it works for you guys, so I'm not in your way. And make sure the mic is working. So I am recording this presentation, so any classmates that missed it for good reasons that want to catch up, we'll have a recording of it. I'll give the slides to Corey via PDF tonight if I haven't already done so. I'm going to cover two main things here. Again, what is the structure of a closed-end fund, how it fits in the capital markets, what our work is. I also, a couple semesters ago, found it practical to talk a little bit about what it's like to run a registered investment advisory firm. It's where you're an investment firm, financial services, where people pay you a fee to do work for them on their behalf. So I've got a couple slides on that. If you have tons of interest there, ask more questions. If you don't, we'll keep moving forward through the capital markets component. It's pretty much up to you. So what is our firm? I'll give you the 45-second overview. We are an investment management firm. We also conduct research and collect data on closed-end funds. To our knowledge, we're the third largest provider of closed-end funds, though I don't know of a fourth. So we're far behind Lipper and Morningstar or Thompson. We are independent, which means we're not owned by another company. We're fee-only. We don't collect commissions, which is one version of our business, and our family does control the entity. Our oldest thing that we do that's special is for about 20 years, we've interviewed portfolio managers at closed-end funds. My father started in 1988 after that bear market or that financial crisis, or not crisis, that bad day in the market, I guess. And we send it out now over email to lots of folks. We just interviewed Prospect Capital, which is a $3.5 billion business development closed-end fund. I'll touch on it briefly, but they're kind of regular closed-end fund cousins, but they trade right now over $70 million a day. 100 employees up in New York, very interesting business, and if you want to delve into it, I have a 6,000-word interview with the manager, just got released on Saturday. We have discretionary portfolio management, which means you don't call us and we don't have to ask permission to make trades. You sign a limited power of attorney that says, John, I have a block of money. You're going to do it your way. Go. So we don't have to call for permission. We get to have our clients be in a model. People look, accounts look generally the same. And we can act on 5 minutes if we feel we need to. and it's really a much stronger progression in our business to go that way. I know advisors who have to get permission for a lot of their work, and I don't know how they find time to sleep at night. We have a new service that covers all closed ends, a weekly data, as I mentioned, now a best ideas list. We do some consulting work, and we have about an 1,100 member group on LinkedIn, which is big for our sector. For closed end funds, and by the way, you're gonna miss some of the bottoms of some of these slides, but you'll have the PDFs if you really need the information, or I'll cover them. For closed end funds, we're gonna talk about how they're inefficient. And we think that's a great thing. Less, as you'll see later, less than 2% of the population owns them. They tend to trade with wider bid-ask spreads. They're just not as well known. Many people go their entire lives and they don't even know they exist, yet as you'll learn, they've been around for 120 years. And that's like what it's like to run a registered investment advisory firm. So this is that slide. I thought I'd share briefly with you what it's like the last 13 years to help run our business. We have to have an investment model or a product that meets a client demand. Somebody has to trade their dollars for our intellectual property or service. It's the same for any business. But you have to do that or people won't hire you or won't keep you. We're blessed. A lot of our clients stay with us about average 10 years. And because they're mostly older when they find us, that it's not because they change their mind after 10 years. It's usually they've consolidated or they've passed things on to estate and heirs. A firm has a chance to develop a culture, a personality. You know, how do you want to work? Do you want to be team-based, individual-based? What do you care most about? One of our my associate wishes we had napping pods like Google. I don't see it happening, but doesn't mean we don't all want to nap some days. You've got to monitor what's going on in the economy and the stock market. They're related. The stock market generally predicts the economy 6 months out. That's what most people say. Different factors affect credit markets and the stock market. I'm not going to delve into that. That's your learning from Corey. But you have to have an idea of what you think is going to happen and what investments can tap into that to make good results for your clients. And that, I think, needs to be a big part of your core process. You then have to remind people why they pay you. And one of the benefits of our business is very few of our clients actually stroke a check to us regularly. Most people in our business, if you have an account with us, the money gets pulled out of the account quarterly based on a pre-negotiated amount. So you don't have to actually think of it as an extra line item to your household budget, but you still have to show value for the work that you're doing, as we call that value for your fee. And then you have to have a platform to do your job. You have to have computers at work. You have to have data. You have to have, our Verizon router went out the other day. So I bought these little tiny USB Wi-Fi adapters and I have a hotspot. So we're a four-person office in the office. So that will solve that next time that we don't actually go down on data for more than a couple hours. You've got to have things like that that in some ways are silly and boring, but help you do your job when you need to do your job. Good vendors, good people. And this is a great business if you love it. It's hard to do, but it's exciting when you do it well. And I couldn't imagine doing anything else. It's been 13 years, and I don't know what else I would do if I hadn't stumbled on this. My dad needed some help. All right, am I too far? Maybe I'm too far from it. All right, so a closed-end fund is a fixed amount of capital. So what that means is, have y'all covered IPOs? You've heard of, didn't Twitter do something, Facebook? So when a stock is born on the stock market, capital is raised. Investors have shares. Closed-end funds are raised the same way. They're born. They're created at one moment. And a $1 billion or a $500 million, they're not as exciting as other IPOs, but that's how they're created. And then the managers take that capital and buy stocks or buy bonds, whatever they're mandated to do by the prospectus that people gave them their money to go do. Suddenly then, if you own the shares and you want your money back, like Corey mentioned, you don't go back to the fund manager and say, I've got 1,000 shares, give me back my money, what's it worth? No, you go to the open market. How do you trade any other common or operating stock? You go to the market and you meet at the bid-ask spread. I mean, same thing for closed-end funds. What's interesting is rarely do these things trade anywhere near their net asset value. And for 90% of closed-end funds, net asset value is calculated daily. And yet you see most funds trading 2 to 3% premiums, sometimes not as common, but 5, 10, 15, 20% discounts to net asset value, which is effectively what the portfolio is worth at any given moment. Now, we'll get into a little bit why we think they trade those discounts, but this trading creates, in our opinions, inefficiencies. As I said, people react to a headline. Yellen said this, Bernanke said that. You know, bonds are going to go this direction. The movement tends to be magnified in closed-end funds because, again, there's less trade volume and they're mostly owned by individual investors. I have a slide later that is a great snapshot of how even funds in the same sector react dramatically different during the same trading day. That is, to me, something if you can figure out how to extract value from is interesting and a chance to make money for your clients in a unique way. And again, they are primarily yield-oriented vehicles, so they're generally used by retired folks or people in IRAs or people with big tax bills that like the municipal side of the sector because a third of all the funds are municipal bonds. I'm not going to really cover this. This is part of from our pitch book. It's just we've done this for a long time. We do it better than most people, and we'll move on to the fun stuff. So there's about $251 billion in closed-end funds. Does that sound like a lot of money? Does anyone know how much money is in open-end funds? Last I heard, and I don't track it actively, it's over $13 trillion. So it's a smaller part of the capital markets, but it's viable. Again, it's got U.S. equity, non-U.S. equity, specialty equity, which would be like REITs, master limited partnerships, preferred equity. Again, generally yieldy things are packaged in a closed fund structure because they're allowed to borrow money through preferred stock. So you can take a municipal bond, a utility, a preferred equity, and whatever you want that has cash flow, a dividend paying stock, you can borrow generally about 20 to 40% of the money at rates that average 1 to 2% max from almost every fund, implied leverage cost, and then buy more things yielding 4, 5, 6 and accrete more income to your shareholders. So you can't do that in open-end fund. They can only lever through derivatives. They can't do it through traditional borrowing. And you can't, especially for municipal bonds, you might think, well, I can margin my account. I own 25 common stocks. I can margin my account and I'm leveraged. You can. Probably your leverage terms are less favorable. One of our clients borrows about $8 million and he pays 4%. And as I said, the average closed-end fund is 1% to 2% in actual cost. So it's hard to have amazing leverage costs outside of the structure. Especially for municipal bonds, you actually can't keep the tax benefits of a muni bond if you use margin unless you have leverage that allows for that, and municipal bond funds have that in place. Next semester, we'll have to figure out how to get every quarter we say this, but how to get my stuff to look right. Liquidity. There is 7% of closed-end funds that trade under $100,000 a day. I heard Tim talking about liquidity for one of the stocks he's looking at for the student portfolio. I don't know the number, but I'm pretty sure it's more than that. It's hard to find funds that trade over $2 to $5 million a day, which means it takes days to build large positions. Now, that doesn't preclude it from happening. We picked up a data client last fall. I didn't know this would happen, but I saw a 13 filing. Do people know what 13 notices are? It's where an institution has to disclose its positions if it's over $100 million in assets or has over 5% of the stock. So it's a public disclosure of ownership for any common stock, which includes closed-end funds as a listed investment company. They had zero closed-end funds in September. They had about 700 million closed-end funds in February. They got very busy very quickly. And as I told you, it's not a huge market, and they only owned about 10 or 15 funds. They got very busy, maybe 20 funds, but it was not a big list. It can be done, but it probably took them 60 days to invest. So you can't change your mind on a dime, typically closed-end funds. Discounts tend to persist. This line here, see if I got the laser pointer. This is equity funds. Discounts have been very normal. About an 8-9% is normal. That's, again, don't expect 7, don't worry about 11. The yield of your closed-end funds, after Bernanke talked about a change in bond markets, drifted down from premiums or narrow discounts down to much wider levels. We're now at a very exciting point in closed-end funds because we've experienced this extra pain in the pricing of the funds. And I think that's very attractive. Average fund trades about 7 discount right now, and normal is 4. So that's not a huge amount, but that's it for retired folks looking to make incremental alpha, incremental income. It's a very useful place. This chart here I like. This here is the income-only yield for U.S. equity funds. Again, 3%. That's what's coded as income by the fund company annually. We've got special equity up at the 4% range. We've got taxable bond funds blending at 7 income-only yield, and they get that from leverage and fixed capital. Muni bonds up over 6. That's just what's coded purely as income. And again, these are rather high levels. The total yield is the market price yield. That's what you pay as a shareholder in the open market at a given time. The blue line we like to look at, because if we back out leverage and we back out discounts or premiums, you get what the manager has to blend. So these are high levels. If you haven't looked at the market, you know, nothing below 4. The manager's blending over 4, and everyone's getting pretty much 6 to 8 on average for most closed-end funds. That, to me, is a huge benefit. So remember, they have net asset values almost always daily, and then they have market prices, which print every time they trade. This is just the 5 major groups of funds, 50 to 100 funds per group. So again, it's not a specific fund, but this is the correlation on a 90-day basis between net asset value and market price, printed for about 2 years. Taxable bond funds are the orange-yellow line, very near correlated, very wide. Some very big movements, not just in what the underlying guts are doing, but what in perceived value or sentiment or fear and greed driving these trade decisions in a way that, again, you can't get an open-end fund. And an exchange-traded fund, if you study them, when they go to a premium, they get rid, you know, they people will what create more of them and sell them at the premium. There's an arbitrage factor built in ETFs. I'm by no means an expert on them, but it keeps them very close 99% of the time to net asset value. You get this with closed-end funds, and to me, I think it's just fascinating. So there's about 46 million households that own open-end funds, about 40% of the U.S. household population. ETFs, it's growing. This is from 2 years ago, 3 million. Closed-end funds are 120 years old, 100 years older than ETFs, and there are only 2 million registered shareholders in the U.S. population. So they're historically been there. There's almost 600 of them, but they're just not easily as understood and utilized by most Americans. And by the way, if you use them, you typically are older because you're usually retired, and you typically have more income and more assets than ETFs or open-end funds. And this all comes from ICI stats. So we talked about the premium. Basically, it prints that asset value. Imagine that asset value always being the same. That's the blue line. And then there's those cycles above and below. What we think is important, yes, premiums are generally bad, discounts are generally good. But we often say, well, what's normal for a fund? Like, is a 4 discount normal? And again, most people can't answer that. But if you look at a simple chart, this is an emerging market bond fund that generally shows periods of premiums and discounts. So I love to use it in this slide. It was at a premium and then wasn't very fun. We didn't own it at a 4 premium. We would have never owned it at a 4 premium. Sentiment shifted, and it shifted to a more than 2 discount. So in a very short period of time, there was 6% of value lost on a bond fund in probably under a week. And the fund itself pays about 6% a year in coupon. So that puts you why you should know what a normal level is for a fund if you're going to buy it, and what news and what conditions would change the valuation of a closed-end fund. Not just it's cheap in the last year. Well, what's happened in the last year? Is that a reasonable range to determine if it's cheap? And then what should the next 12 months look like? So you see these little trends. I mean, they move around a bit. And again, this is completely separate from the actual guts of the portfolio, the work of the manager being done. And again, this is the little types of things that people tend to love about closed-end funds. This is the average closed-end fund, much easier chart to look at than the one with all the 5 groups. They're rich, they bottomed out tax loss selling at 9 discounts, and they've been pretty stable this year. So the guts have done what they've done, but the valuation from investors has been very flat, flatter than we've seen for any prolonged period of time in the previous 2 years. This is a 2-year chart, or almost a 2-year chart. And again, another version of that chart. So if you're interested in closed-end funds, as you might suspect, you're probably yield-focused. If you were to say, I want to be half equity, half bond, and half the bond is going to be municipal bond, so clearly it'll be a taxable account, because it would be strange in most cases to put a municipal bond in an IRA or tax qualified, because you wouldn't reap the benefits of the tax-free income. you blend at a 7.3 yield. Does anyone know what the 30-year treasury is at? Ballpark, within 100 basis points? It's like four?
Three six.
Yeah, I mean, that's you give our government your money for 30 years, your best credit out there, and again, this is not risk-free, but it's almost double the 30-year government bond as the average half-equity, half-taxable bond, half-municipal bond. That's what's been driving more interest in these funds in the last few years, because people need to produce income to be retired, and these structures tend to do it very well. And they do it, again, through the fixed capitalization, which I didn't talk about. If you have a market panic, and we had one a few years ago, closed-end fund market prices did not fare well, but the managers never had to sell a single security because of investor demand. Yet bond open-end funds, and even equity open-end funds, if investors asked for their money back, they had to liquidate securities the same day, or keep a credit, some sort of credit line to hand, which has cost to do it a little longer than that. There, you have prices falling of their positions, not because the manager doesn't like it, because that they may be forced to sell. They may be forced to sell the holdings because you want your money back. And that's a benefit I forgot to mention that you don't get. And so that, to me, is one of the benefits of this structure, the fixed capitalization, and then the ability to leverage. And then, of course, you have discounts, which often are available. Breaking out by yield, they're all pretty much higher. Like I said, discounts drive that, leverage drives that. So how do we get to that? I've suggested it. Let's show it mathematically. Nuveen, people heard of Nuveen Investments, large shop in up in Chicago. They have a ton of muni bond funds. So we took high credit quality ones, four of them. We've used the same four for years. Four leveraged, four unleveraged. So same fund sponsor, you get a 4-2 blend on the unlevered and a 5-8 on the levered. And this is on net asset value, so it doesn't even count market price, because I want to know what the manager is actually able to produce, which implies or imputes, where is it? Well, it's about 1.6%. It's right here. You can't see it? So about 1.6% extra yield just from leverage, net cost of leverage being employed, which means you borrow at 1 or 2 and you buy at 4. And you reap that spread of 3, and it helps produce more income for your shareholders. The other way, and this is a very deeply discounted one, so this is why I show it, it's net asset value yields 9.5, which is too high, but it's what the funds are doing, so it's fine. But because it's at a large discount of 15, you're getting 170 basis points or 11.2 yield because you're buying below par. Doesn't change what the manager's doing, and it could go deeper, but you just bought a forward cash flow at 11.2. Now, this assumes a couple of things. One, that the cash flow won't change. And bonds can stop paying on their credit. Equities can stop paying dividends. Part of what we do is determine how risky that distribution is to see if it's likely to be here in 3 to 6 months. But that's an important part of what drives this. All right. There's a lot of data to look at. I'm going to really focus on three main ones. But for those that really are intrigued, you can dig into some more. These are the terms that I find. Again, we collect tons of data. These are the main ones we find the most important. But if you can answer three questions, I think you can buy a closed-end fund. How is its manager doing? So remember, this is active management. So you have to understand what sector is it in, and is he actually providing a value for his fee? Because he's an investment company and charging a fee. So net asset value performance is important based on what it should be doing and based on what its peers are doing. That's one thing we think is highly important. Two, is it cheap or expensive? And as I suggested, it doesn't mean always buy the discount, sell the premium. I think premiums over 3 are hard to own because it's easy for them to, things happen that tend to knock it down over time. The third thing I think is the most important for 80% of closed-end funds, because those are the ones that pay monthly or quarterly and have a yield over 5. Is the dividend going to be here? Is it going to go up or down? Is it plausible? Does getting a 15% yield, make any rational sense based on the holdings? And there's a fund where my answer is no, but it still does it. So we try to avoid dividend cuts, and I'll show you a very bad case of that later, and we try to experience dividend increases, because suddenly, if you experience a dividend cut, the cash flow changed, and as you'll see later, the discount tends to widen, often dramatically if it's a big cut. And if you have a dividend increase, suddenly the discount should narrow in most cases, and you have more cash flow on a forward-looking basis. That's what we're trying to experience. Again, it's not home runs. I say closed-end funds are singles and doubles. And we're fine with that because you don't need to have home runs. Most people can't do home runs every year. These are screens that we run regularly. And I'll say, you know, we looked in our data. There's 209 funds we ran this screen. Need to be liquid, wider discount than normal, above yield than normal, above earnings coverage, which is one metric we use for dividend risk. Good NAV return, which is the manager. So it's not like income at the detriment of performance, which we see in some closed-end funds. People and munis hate taxes. AMT is a type of tax. We try to reduce that exposure. Return of capital is a way of giving you back your money. And to me, in a bond fund, never makes sense. Makes some sense in equity funds, which we'll get into a little bit if we have time or questions after. And then we look over the dividend history and other things. Out of 209 funds, 8 screen to this. Now, I'm not going to say I would never buy a fund that doesn't screen in this list, but it gives me a very focused list to go from, again, 200 down to 8, and then I can read the manager's commentary. Then I can get into more granular data screening based on my particular needs for a portfolio. Then the equity side, again, a little less liquidity because I needed to get where I wanted to go. 5 discount, basically cheap, reasonable dividend policy, nothing too crazy, good NAV performance. And there's some expense ratios that are crazy. We screen those out. 16 of 226. So again, you take a relatively small neighborhood and you can bring it down to 24 things to look at that you already know meet predetermined criteria of good performance, reasonably cheap, reasonable dividends. And then you dig into the hard work of deciding if you want to actually allocate capital to that fund. This I'm not going to cover in depth, but I pulled 2 slides, actually 3 slides from a presentation we just designed last month. Muni bonds were really expensive. Both the bonds and then the closed-end fund versions of them. They were at 3 premiums, and then they dropped to 9 discounts. So in January, I thought that was cheap. And then we thought that now might be a time to offer a municipal-only bond portfolio, so service for clients. I thought suddenly now we have enough data to screen for good things. Things are cheap, because remember, if anyone starts an investment, hedge fund, REA firm, wait till things get really cheap because then your inception performance will look much better than if you wait till they're really expensive. So I pulled a bunch of data, as I said here, premiums bottomed out. MLK weekend, I went to the office that Monday and I basically designed this slide and have my data manager flesh it out. What are we going to talk about? What do we need to look at? Discounts, the fact that there's 205 funds, $63 billion. Earnings coverages are trending higher, but that's near 100%, which is, we think, good. Discounts are averaging 6.5%. It was a little narrower for nationals at the time. Yielding 6.3. State funds tend to yield less. There's leverage, and there's more duration. If you know, anyone cover duration yet? You don't do bonds yet? Duration for a bond or a fund, it's how positive or negative will the price of that investment do when rates go up or down. So the bigger the number, the more magnified the results are. 11 duration is considered relatively high duration. I mean, 5 is considered low, 3 to 5 in our experience. But closed-end managers generally lean into durations of 8 to 15. So you blend at 11, you've got to be willing to have longer duration to be in the structure. But I think with the discounts and the fixed capital and the fact that we're not going to buy a fund and own it for 5 years, that we're going to look to trade it for inefficiencies, I think gives it a chance to do. So to develop this slide, just on all closed-end funds, again, this is the earnings coverage, which means they say they pay 10 cents a month. What do they earn? We look at that ratio, we graph it over 2 years, it's been trending higher. This, to me, is a very positive thing. I thought good time to do this model. Another balance sheet item that assesses risk or pulling reserves to pay a dividend, the UNII, which is undistributed net investment income. So you buy bonds, you cover your leverage, you pay shareholders what's left over. This has been a very stable line, very positive. But here's the thing. You buy the ETF, you get 3.3 yield. If you have ridiculous taxes, because that's really where this makes sense, you get tax equivalent yields of 5.7 and in New York State, 6. This is the guts of the closed-end fund portfolio. It blends 4.5. That's the net asset value yield after leverage is backed out. Jumps you up. So that's a relatively peer-to-peer comparison. A little more duration here, but still a big jump. You add discounts, and you add leverage, and then discounts. you're getting to an 11-12 tax equivalent yield if you have a high income person here. What does that mean? That means to get the same after-tax results, you have to find a taxable bond yielding over 11. So if you're in that bucket, not again, not everyone is, clearly, not everyone makes $1 million household income, but it really drives people to this sector. So we developed the model for New York because it was the one where we see that the highest tax rates, if you make too much money in New York, you're paying 52% income, highest in this country. But then here, for the, that was just the average fund. This is actually the model we designed. You're getting 12, no, you're getting the 12s if you're in the high income bracket. So that's why we designed the product. We just closed the first account, paperwork next week, looking forward to managing it, should be tons of fun. Then we dropped our fee by two-thirds, but up the minimum by three, which is the same dollar terms, but it's a more boring model, so we had to adjust our fee schedule because that was a business decision to close the revenue. So dividend changes, so, and you're getting most of them, but in a given six-month period, there's about 2,500 dividend announcements, and 90% are no change, great. I expected it, no worries. Increases, again, fluctuates around them, but there's about 5%, sometimes it's 6, sometimes it's 4, increases, 5% decreases. The average change, though, plus 10, minus 11. I mean, that's not tweaking. So we break it out. Under 5% increase, about 2. Over 5% increase, 20. There have been some very large increases for some of the equity funds. Bond funds, you're going to miss the one of the numbers, but small number is negative 2.5. You can't see it. Negative 17.6. The decrease is over 5. So the point is, when they're big, they're big. When they're small, they're small. They really do bucket out in that direction. I'm going to look at the screen. All right. All right, so this first group is U.S. equity, mostly gains. Non-U.S. equity, which is like international stocks. About 50-50, but mostly gains. Sector funds, mostly gains. Taxable bond funds, and this is in the last 6 months. We update this every 6 months to give a sense of what actually is happening now. More cuts than gains. Now, a year ago, it was the muni funds with the big cuts versus gains. Munis have stabilized. But these are very painful experiences because you bought a bond fund if you're on this side, and there were 85 notices in the last 6 months that the dividend went down. And again, only 5% of the announcements, but they're usually very big for most funds. So if you buy a closed fund at a premium, and this is funny, it's now almost four-year-old data, two equity funds paying very large distribution rates. And they cut their distribution on a Friday, 45%, 54%, and dramatic cuts. The day before the news, 3 premium, 4 discount. Then within a week, here's one. You missed the bottom of the chart, but it's not a very slow cascade. You open and, you know, here's the day before. Somebody knew about it because clearly there was some movement. Then it opens lower and falls like a rock. And then more people catch it, opens, falls like a rock, and then it starts to stabilize. But a third of the value is lost in a week, and your future cash flow is cut by half. To me, that's a risk you want to avoid. So to do that, try to avoid premiums and try to avoid ridiculous dividends. IPOs, there's only been 2 this year, but there's 25 last year. The average is about 25 a year, about $20 billion in assets total is the peak, about 10 on the lower end usually. So 10 to 20 billion created on what's currently a $250 billion market. So it's not a huge amount, and we do lose some through open endings or liquidations from time to time. There are deaths, or the graveyards. But we had $14.5 billion created last year, and it pretty much stopped after Bernanke opened his mouth. So that's pretty much the first 7-8 months of the year. It really was on track to do a great number until that happened. I think it'll pick up a little bit, but we've only had 2 this year, and they've been very small. They've only averaged $350 million in assets, versus where we had averaged for 2 years over $500 million in assets and have recovered from, again, we were better than so far. We're going to beat this year. We're going to beat 08. I'm confident. Actually, we already doubled 08. If you want to know what IPO, ticker symbols here, fund name, generally don't buy in the IPO, have an article about it. This is the market price versus IPO price. I only see 1 over 100. So Everyone else has lost 10 to 20% of their initial value. Now, there's been a dividend in there, so you can probably add back in 3 to 4%, maybe 5% in best case. But we see discounts, like we said. This is the lost price and discounts of 4 to 12%. This is a problem in our sector. It's hard to own these, buy these on the IPO. I hope in my career somebody, maybe one of you guys, will figure out how to solve this problem, how to create an IPO without this friction and this initial typical loss in the first 6 to 9 months. But it's, again, why, if you know anyone that someone says, hey, so-and-so called my mother or grandmother and they wanted them to buy a closed-end fund IPO, just say no. The fund sponsors don't like me saying that because they create them. We need them to create them because we want to trade them 9 to 12 months later. But yeah, mergers, 10 a year is normal. Graphically, it has picked up consolidation in the sector. Deaths, people think these things, you know, are going to be killed. ETFs have grown tremendously. We lost some in the 2000s, but nothing crazy. Max at about 12 per year. Last 3 years, it's averaged 3 to 4 to 5 funds. I mean, we're not being destroyed by ETFs. They prove their purpose. ETFs, in my opinion, are exposure vehicles. You want to be in the sector. They do it efficiently and usually with a lot of liquidity. These are inefficient, yieldy, just, you know, buy the inefficiencies and the yield and try to do better than... It's hard to be the billion-dollar hedge fund and do these. Again, it's been proven some can, but it takes a lot of hard work. And then this just shows you the decline in liquidations. Common mistakes, I covered it on the IPO. Only buying at a discount, some 20% discounts are really justified and may never change. Because if they could, the activists would come and do it. And if, you know, 20 discount is very hard to maintain for more than a few weeks if there isn't a long-term reason for it to exist. 15 discounts are considered wide, 5 to 12 are normal for equity, 3 to 7 or 8 are normal for bond, and right now bonds are a little wider than normal. And while I've said yield's there, we think yield's great, you don't just buy the, because of the yield, because what you see, you type the ticker in your system, and you go, oh, the yield is, well yes, and I only know your name, Tim. Yes, Tim, because they pay 5 cents a month, and their market price is Y, so that gives them this yield. But what can change? Well, the yield can go up or down. And so you can't just, like, the yield's not guaranteed the way a bond is. A bond isn't a guarantee, but a bond says, you give me $1,000, I'll pay you 5% a year, and in 10 years, I'll give you your money back. That's a 10-year bond. And unless they default or can't make the payment, you get the cash flow and the principal. I mean, that's the scenario. But a closed-end fund, even a bond closed-end fund, is an equity. Because remember, it's an investment company listed on the stock market. It derives its value from bonds, and it will trend in the direction of bonds as a net asset value will go up when bonds do well, and net asset value will go down when bonds do poorly. But it's an equity. I mean, don't forget it's an equity. And if I didn't cover it thoroughly, but the volatility of these things are definitely more in the current market than most bond investments. Some people hear volatility and they go, oh my gosh, that's risky. I can't be in a lot of volatility. Well, I hear volatility, and I've done this for 13 years. I go, wow, well, I'm going to try to buy a little bit cheaper than normal and try to sell a little bit more expensive than normal. I mean, volatility is your friend if you can be diligent, patient, diversified. I mean, don't bet the entire account on one idea, even in a closed-end fund, which is technically a diversified investment. Just own them forever. I mean, I'm not saying if you buy 15 closed-end funds and own them for 50 years, you'll be, you know, you won't do okay or even possibly well. Because of the inefficiency, I just think that you could do better by paying attention periodically. I mean, you don't have to go to work. You don't have to do it 8 hours a day. But yeah, I think you should do it regularly, if that's monthly or quarterly. I mean, I think there's opportunities to be had from picking up on trends. And to me, it's leaving money on the table by not making a change. And it's hard because it does take some work, but I think that, like anything that takes work, it can be worth it. I'm still talking to this guy, it's been 8 years. I've lost so much in my closed-end funds, I'll give you the money if I can get back to cost basis. Okay, so, and it's an interesting scenario. It happens in other investments, I'm sure. People know what they paid for something, and they just can't sell it to realize the loss, because then they had to admit that they took a loss. And it's interesting, you know, some people say that like closed-end funds that have a long-term track record, 5-10 years of good performance. Well, that's fine. I'm not against funds with good long-term track records, but our data pretty much is on a 1 week to 1 year basis. Because my thought is this, every week, the closed-end funds that we own for our clients have to prove they should be there, and that there isn't enough, like we usually about a half standard deviation of pricing or a new updated earnings that we don't like or updated some data point. But about a half standard deviation, to me, I can work on that. I mean, that's enough. And every week they have to prove that it should still be there, and then we decide, do we switch? And so I switched two funds this week for our portfolios. I mean, we own about 50, so it wasn't a huge move, but I don't understand thinking it. I think you should be more active, but that's because it's what I do for a living. I guess it's my bias. Or people say, gosh, there's a closed fund that made, two that made over 60% total return last year. One was in healthcare. Actually, there's two. They're sister funds, healthcare biotech. Okay, makes sense. Look at the healthcare stocks. They did well. One of them was a credit fund that wandered its way into equities in the summer and made some amazingly good decisions. People were so confused by this fund that was considered a senior loan credit style fund, which is a type of bond investment, that it wandered to a 20 discount in December on a 60% net asset value total return. And I'm reading the discussion boards on it. Well, I don't know. I don't trust it. I'm like, well, I'd watched it act differently. We worked into it in the second quarter, and it just kept performing so well. I'm like, this is crazy. So I called up the fund. I didn't know who they were. I said, I can't get you into our Scott letter because of we only do six a year production schedule. Can I interview you and I'll put you on my blog? Because I'm like, I got to figure out what the heck this thing is doing. They made two very good calls. They bought AMR Corp in near bankruptcy, and when they were proven wrong, they doubled down. And then they lost like 50% on their investment, and they doubled the investment. And it's a manager with the guts to do that, and he was proven right. They then bought a broadcasting firm that they thought was cheap and ripe for acquisition, and Media General bought them at a 60% premium. So lucky, but also in a manager that, like, gosh, he buys bonds usually, but when he sees great opportunity, he'll work into the equity side. And they've done okay this year. They're up 20% this year as well. So it's been a, and yet their market price is trending down because, again, it's a really funny scenario to do. So I don't think why you should just say, I made money, I'm going to sit on it, and if I lose more, I'll sell. I mean, if you have a better idea, buy it. And then avoid high premiums or high yield just because for the heck of it. It's funny, my associate says I'm only allowed to use these slides in your class because they're not appropriate for regular investors. But I like these smiley faces. Fear and greed. 85% of these owners are individual investors. They're not hedge funds. They're not institutionals. I mean, there's not enough liquidity, and there's no reason for an institution to buy a muni bond fund that's not just ridiculously cheap because they don't pay taxes in that way. There's no tax equivalent yield benefit for an institution. So I think most individual investors make silly decisions some of the time. Sometimes they make great decisions. Some of them impress me, and I end up taking their information and I add it to what I've learned. I mean, I met a guy in the last month that I hope, impressive, very impressive. And the structure gives you net asset value, and it gives you market price, and they vary over time, and I think you can capture that. We say if you like the discount and the asset value, then go in, but don't just buy one or the other. So this actually just was launched. One of my friends has a website that's based on 13 filings and then market price and NAV data. We use them to help validate our data, but he's a programmer, I'm not. We love partnering together. There were separate businesses. This launched last week. It's called a tree map, technically, the way it's structured, though he calls it a heat map because it sounds more fun marketing-wise. But this was midday yesterday. These are all ticker symbols for closed-end funds. They're bucketed by groups. So here's equity. Here's fixed income. This is taxable. This is munis. And you can't. But so here's a muni fund that's down. Again, big red means big downward movement. And here's a muni fund that's up big. Now, granted, they tend to meet, but there's spotty differences. Bigger red is more negative. Bigger green is more positive. And this is intraday market price movements. And it's just fascinating to me. He's refining the program. It'll look a little cleaner, I'm sure, when he improves it. But that in similar investments, like this is high yield. And there's ups and downs. Why? Well, inefficiency. Maybe one got too expensive yesterday. Maybe one got too cheap yesterday. But that happens on a near daily basis. And if you watch for it, again, you're not going to double your money easily and quickly. But I think for the risk adjusted returns, these things can be fascinating. And I'm so glad he sent me this link. Maybe Monday he sent me the link because I thought it was great timing. You're the first people to see that slide. The philosophy, I mean, really, it's relative value, dividend changes, track the performance of the manager. And if you have a model, like if you think I should be X and this and that, just maintain it. Like if something wanders too big, again, I work with predominantly older people that need cash flow and generally don't like big risk. They take small risk because we're more volatile than like an open-end fund structure, but I think more cash flow, more return. But that's who I'm used to dealing with, so the risk is different than, though I do have a client that's 33, and we just handle his masculine partnership and muni and high yield stuff for him. Performance, the market did 30 last year, equity funds lagged it, but I mean, they're not, closed-end funds aren't designed to track the market. They do different things. There's 50 different funds in there. Some beat the market, some didn't. 25, I think, not bad. This year, though, the market's up 1% to 2%. They're showing better so far this year. Specialty equity, which is a vast group of different sectors, did rather well for what they are last year and have had a very good first quarter. Bond funds. Taxable bond funds held their own. Net asset values were up 5, discounts widened, so most didn't lose money last year, but municipal bonds got clobbered. I mean, this slide, when we ran that in early January, I said, oh my gosh, the average muni bond fund lost 14% total return, which means they lost 20 market price in a year. Like, now you get in. When this John Templeton, if you don't know who he is, he passed away, I think, 3 years ago. One of his more famous quotes is, when there's blood in the streets, you buy. If it's a reasonable decision, like you're not buying a company with no earnings that might get delisted next week. But when there's blood in the streets, if you feel the most uncomfortable about buying a sector or a market, might be the best time because if everyone was really excited about it, it's probably overvalued. These are all of our models. They keep growing. I think when I met Corey, I think we just launched this model here. But these are the products we offer. I won't go into them, that's why I'm here, but we income focus, equity and bond focus. This is the first portfolio we've offered that doesn't have any equity exposure, and none of our equity models have pure equity, they all have some bond. So we've always believed before today to have some sort of equity bond balance. But again, this is should be launching next week if the paperwork goes through properly. Two very common examples. I need 7 and change yield a year, try to grow up more than inflation. I'm not saying it's easy and risk-free, but that client, I have one client of mine I have, that's not his photo, but I always think of him for this model. We've been doing that since 2009, been tons of fun. And then because the municipal bond stuff only needs 5% a year, but wants mostly a good 20% tax-free exposure. We can do that very well in a foundation balance model. We do that with the taxable side of the foundation balance. And the last slide, and then I've got some time for questions, I think, right? Do we have are we done right now?
No, what time is it?
6:15?
No, we have till 6:45.
Half an hour question? I told you I'd be faster this quarter.
Yes, you're faster.
Or my semester. I graduated, so I don't use semester anymore, I use quarters. These investments are yield-driven, right? They are not an actual one bond or one stock. They are typically 50 to 100 equities and 2 to 400 bonds in a given portfolio. People ask why there are more bonds in a closed-end fund than equities in an equity fund. Well, because a single company might have 30 bonds. So you have to buy. You might have 5 bonds from one company, but that's still registered as 5 different bonds. They are diversified and they are actively managed. There's leverage. Now, what I haven't talked about, though I have time, so I can delve a little bit. Leverage. So rates are going to go. Who believes rates aren't going to go up in the next 5 to 10 years? Anyone think that we'll be at same rates? Okay, so everyone says rates are going to go up. If we've borrowed long and we buy either bonds or equities that have a yield, so they kind of trade like bonds, like utility stocks won't go down in actual long-term growth as a company, if rates go up, but investors' decision to own them will shift if rates go up. I mean, so that does change the pricing of the utilities or the utility funds. When rates go up, leverage is going to be, could be painful. So we've been collecting data this year, and we're working on more into this year, so that when we get there, we can attempt to be less hurt by leverage. We can either lower the leverage, we can look for less leverage cost. On the bond side, we can look at maturities and duration. For munis, there's something else. There's lots of little things we're collecting that we think we can do. But at the end of the day, I mean, our business is we're closed-end fund advisors. We didn't create the firm. It was created by another fellow in Santa Barbara 25 years ago. But it's what we do. It's we're going to basically continue to build portfolios around them because that's, you know, it's what we do. There is a type of closed-end fund I mentioned, BDCs. There's 47. There are 40 a year ago. They're $30 billion in assets versus the $250 for regular. They're fascinating, and most of them will not be impacted by rising rates. And they tend to yield between 8 to 12 because they are, in many ways, riskier than regular closed-end funds. And they only price their net asset value quarterly because most of their investments don't price regularly. So they have to have an evaluation committee determine what things are worth. That doesn't happen daily. So it is a different environment, but we're collecting data on them. We have for about a month. If I come next semester, I'll have more information on them. I'll probably have a couple slides on them. We think by leverage, focusing on that sector of the closed-end fund market, we'll be able to build some more income, yet less leverage risk or duration risk in the future. But that's something we've done to try to avoid that future scenario for closed-end funds. And then if you buy an equity fund that trades at a 14 discount, and it never trades narrower than a 14 discount, ever, like for 1,000 years, being a little hypothetical here or a little ridiculous, you've bought a dollar with 86 cents. So if that dollar performs well, the manager does a reasonable job, it's a sector you should be in, you've cost-free levered your portfolio. As in, if you had bought SPY, which is the SP 500 ETF, or a similar correlating closed-end fund at an 15 discount, which there are three or four right now that correlate rather high to SPY, you control more, you have that extra money in the market. And some people go, but I can't narrow the discount. Well, maybe one day you will. Who knows? Maybe a dissident will close them up, you'll capture it. But even if you never do, if it's a good manager, you have better long-term performance because you controlled a dollar with 85 cents and there wasn't a margin, there was any interest associated with it. So a lot of people miss that in closed-end funds where, yeah, discounts may close great, but just having that discount there can be a benefit. And if you choose to, you can use limit orders. Like I've got orders in for a couple of clients I may never see, but they're out there for a month. I picked a price I was willing to pay. If it happens, great. If it doesn't, then I'll reassess. Like, I'm patient. I can hold cash and wait, or I can wait. I mean, I don't have to do it today. And if you can have that mindset, this structure can work for you. And then I think that fixed capitalization, when we see interest rates rise, and any of you happen to either own open-end bond funds or work in that neighborhood of the market, I'm just curious what's going to happen when open-end funds with reasonable duration get clobbered, not just by rising rates, but redemptions. Because that's going to be forced selling of bonds. And I could bet there'll be closed-end fund managers just waiting to take that trade. They'll have capital sitting there, or they'll have borrowed money, and they'll make the market for those open-end funds looking to trade. I think that's going to be a huge benefit why I like them. And then, they're inefficient. So I think that's it. Here's a one-shot overview on closed-end funds, ETFs, and open-end funds. Again, just because they're the three main investment company structures, we don't talk about UITs because they don't trade. I really don't like UITs. Our closest competitor does them or advises on them. If you thought this stuff was cool, these are all free websites, either discussion forums or data. This is my friend Al's website. I'm going to spend a moment. Here's a guy that worked at Google, programmed a website on the bus to and from every day, got so distracted, wanted to leave Google. They said, no, we'll put you on sabbatical for a year, Google. I mean, And since last fall, he's been programming like crazy. And luckily, he has enough. He's done really well. He can actually do this and figure out how the revenue will come later. And he's been tons of fun to work with because, and he collects data, but not from our. Because I have a data team that collects data, and I can have him validate my data. Which again, if I do good data work, I have to prove it's good, and he helps me do that. So, ton of fun to watch him grow his website. I hope he stays successful. Because he does stuff that I can't dream of. In fact, when he emailed me about the heat map, he goes, I actually, when I decided on this, I know this is something that John and his data team can't do because we're not programmers. He goes, great. Do everything you can do the stuff I can't do because then I can help you with the stuff we're good at and you can help me with the stuff I'm not good at. Other comment I'll say is the closed-end fund world, about 10 focused institutions do it. There's about 20 analysts, if that, handful of vendors. Most of us are friends and know each other, and we're rather friendly. As one of them put it to me, he used to be the analyst at Morningstar, now he's at Nuveen. Small enough neighborhood, we're probably going to work together at some point, so we got to stay. It's such a small neighborhood. It's like living in a small town. You really can't piss someone off, or you're going to be shunned and outcasted. So, one or two far off screen. Oh, I got to take that. Okay. Apologize. I forget that animation's in there every semester. Our bios if you care, and then that's the thank you. So questions about either closed-end funds or running an investment firm, or if Corey has anything else he'd rather cover? Yes, sir.
On average, what should
be? Great question. So the average fund, God, the acoustics change right here. The average fund has about 1.5 expense ratio, but 50 basis points is leverage. So they have more expense ratio. I mean, the average management fee is about 1%, which is not cheap, but again, not ridiculous. Now, sectors that have higher, MLP funds have higher expense ratios, both from just they're able to charge higher fees because it's a harder business. They trade more complicated things. I mean, there's only 80 or 90 MLPs, and their leverage costs are higher. But yeah, I mean, they're not. No, Vanguard at 7 basis points.
Are you guys affiliated with Scottish
Fund? No, my father worked there in the 70s, and it's my great great uncle that was a founder. But we never, we're not directly affiliated. My dad did like working for Scottish Fund and having the last name Scott. But Buford, who's still involved heavily, is my second cousin. Yeah, their director of research is one of the foremost experts on business development company closed-end funds. So yeah, so we grabbed coffee last week and has really helped point me in the right direction to collect the data to do that work. But yeah, they're a nice, good Richmond broker-dealer. Been around since 70? I should know this. 70-something? Any other questions? Yes, sir. Yes.
So in May when we had the falling rates, you guys experienced, or that sector experienced more of a decline than you would see in the open market, or the open fund market.
Yes.
So then this recent 3 months, rates have kind of gone back down a little bit and kind of stabilized, and these funds that saw, or the sector of municipal bonds, or intermediate term and long term, have seen gains. It's like 1.5, it's up, but 1.5. And then did you guys see a greater increase in your in those closed-end funds and gains due to the leverage, or was it kind of since it's a bigger setup?
So ballpark, we'll go back to the slide, but the net asset value movements last year for bond funds, again, taxables were, their net asset values were up 5.6% on average. So basically, the average market price or net asset value was down slightly, but the cash flow of 6 or 7 kept investors ahead. The challenge is the market prices got slapped. So if I'd been here a year ago, or if you go listen to that presentation on our blog, I would have said the muni bonds are trading at 3 premiums. They've done great. They perform good yield, but boy, are they expensive. I mean, they were doing, I mean, they're investors that were saying, well, I made 15 to 20% a year for 3 years on muni bond closed-end funds. I'm like, yeah, that sounds like the day it works until it doesn't. I mean, nobody in my sector that I know thought it could happen so quickly and so painfully, but they knew it would happen. They just didn't know when. You asked about the leverage. Yeah, the leverage will help them in that rising rate. The key benefit is the long-term rates for most funds is very, very low. And if we can have, so yeah, the leverage will multiply. So a third leverage will magnify duration by a third, roughly speaking. So that is definitely a factor. If rates can go up in a more easy, low, you know, not jumpy and sporadic, it will give the bond market to kind of roll up a little bit. And it will actually make the rise, I won't say comfortable, but easy. If it's like May, June, painful. So one of our clients we're talking to, what really is important is it's not just rates rising, it's the speed and the the magnitude of the change by time and movement that's really important for bond funds. Okay, so for closed-end fund investors, because the three premiums went to six discounts in various, that's losing a year and a half of income in a few weeks. So if you're an investor that didn't know that was a possible outcome, you didn't know that muni bonds average three or four discounts, and so you're already trading 6% above historical equilibrium. Like, if that wasn't a known factor to you, then it was a very, very painful summer. And we had very little bond exposure. And like I said, it wasn't until I saw blood in the streets that I said, I'll step back in this market. We've had very little muni bond exposure for 98% of our clients up until this year. I started it in 08 when there were 25 discounts. The average national muni bond fund was trading 75 cent dollars in November of 08. I mean, that was true blood. Last year was painful adjustment of sentiment, but 08 was credit crisis. So, I mean, but the portfolios themselves did fine. You just had to avoid selling. And if you're at reasonable discounts and if you don't lose your cash flow, and that's the way I think of the problem, the way I look to build the portfolio. But yeah, good, very good point. Sure. Business development company, closed-end funds. So actually, we interviewed Prospect Capital. They're $3.5 billion in assets. Again, you would probably enjoy reading the interview. I mean, your questions, I can't easily explain in 6,000 words, but they do mezzanine finance. They actually do some equity too, but they do all these types of investments. They have 149 portfolio companies. One thing fascinating is it's not just owning a position in your pooled investment. They often provide advice and help to their investments because these were brought out to allow finance and small companies, because you cannot be too big and receive an investment equity or debt from BDCs. And to allow investors that aren't accredited and can buy a hedge fund access to products that go after investing in these venture capital, mezzanine finance things, yet allows you that liquidity daily versus most hedge funds lock you up. Again, BDCs, the two main risks we found so far, an asset value only prints four times a year, so it's hard to tell the direction of the guts without really knowing the underlying deals, and they pay themselves very well. And their fee structure is usually 2 and 20 for many of them. For 2/3 of them, it's 2 and 20. Yes. So it's more like trading duration risk for credit risk. Yes. And so like Prospect Capital right now yields 12.2. So they are, but they're also they're the only BDC that has an investment grade credit rating. So they clearly don't buy boring, they clearly don't loan money to boring companies, but they've been able to structure themselves as both liquid and have a lot of credit so that the rating agencies believe if something would happen to them, you know, they actually the only BDC that bought another BDC post-crisis, because the other BDC, their banks pulled their credit, and they didn't have a plan B. And as much as possible, the CEO or president at Prospect has plan B and C. Doesn't take the risk away, but also trades $70 million. It just boggles my mind. Most funds, literally, it's 300,000 to 1.5 million is a normal range of closed-end fund trading. So when I saw the stats, I was like, okay, it just boggles my mind. It is. Good question. Anyone else?
John, you said that, I think I saw you in your chart, you said that taxable bond funds got a lot of
money in the last 6 months.
There hasn't been a lot of corporate defaults lately, so were they just paying out more than they were bringing in?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of... a lot of cuts in the global, the emerging market, global income, both dollar denominated and local currency denominated, had some issues. So yeah, there was issues in both. I thought they were overpaying in a lot of ways. And just, we find boards tend to group themselves into two buckets. Because again, the portfolio manager, unless he's chairman of the board, doesn't have a lot of input technically to the dividend policy. So the manager's designed or charged with growing the assets, making the investments. The board of directors does the corporate governance and makes the actual decisions of 10 cents per share, 8 cents. Boards generally make tweaks, and you can see that in their dividend history, like they'll up a little bit, down a little bit, up, you know, you see where it seems they bid, well, the manager said we're going to earn X dollars next quarter, so we'll align the policy to what we're doing. Again, we don't love cuts, but we can appreciate boards that just align dividends to earnings. Then there's those that wait and they hope, and it's like they're praying, and then suddenly the tide's gone out and people realize they weren't wearing a bathing suit. So yeah, I mean, those are the painful market prices when the boards push it too long. That number surprised me how many cuts there were.
Is there some type of regulatory limit to the amount of leverage of the structure?
Yes. So it does vary whether they're doing the types of leverage they have, portfolio or structural leverage. But 50% is the most allowed. BDCs have an exemption. They can actually go higher. That's another benefit potentially of them, is they can really lever. But if you think that leverage over 50% is high, banks are typically leveraged, 500%, 600%? I mean, so you think of a BDC being 60% leverage, it doesn't, I mean, they're none to my knowledge that are, but that is not ridiculous in the scheme of things. In the credit crisis, when the leverage ratios went above 50%, or above what's allowed by the investment regulations, then the funds were precluded from paying dividends until they reduced the leverage. Because remember, the credit crisis was started by the ARPS defaults in 07, if you're in high school then or middle school, but that's how these funds were doing their leverage. And so it was very painful to unwind some of that. So since then, funds have blended permanent leverage, like preferred stock, with a credit line, like a credit card. And they can add up leverage quickly on the credit line, and if they see risk, they can pull it back. And it doesn't require creating or redeeming a publicly listed security. But yeah, that was an issue. But one fund manager was like, you know, we didn't miss a dividend, and it turns out, I can't remember which fund it was, they couldn't pay their November 08 dividend until December. So they paid out the same cents per share in a year, but they weren't allowed to pay in November because of their leverage ratios. That is a very good point.
Are more funds starting to tilt more towards the short-term financing option rather than preferred because of the cost?
Preferred is still very cheap, but the regular preferreds are pretty much done. The munis have gone to various preferred tender option bonds and a whole bunch of, again, types of preferred-like leverage, or preferred leverage, but not auction rate preferreds. Typically, they have the redemption mechanisms, and they're only sold often to life insurance companies, institutions. They're not owned by the retail public, and they're really more just for like money market and life insurance, whole life insurance type portfolios. Rates are so low, there's been 5 years for people to refinance their leverage. So when we see leverage cost, generally speaking, over two, I scratch my head. I won't preclude the investment, but just, you know, we take the average cost per leverage in a given period of time, divide by the average net asset value, which is, you know, the guts of the portfolio, and then we divide that by the percent that's leveraged. So if your cost is $100 million and you're $1 billion investment, then that's 10% cost. And then if you have 10% leverage, that's 1% rate, inferred rate. It's not the actual rates, but it's a way of cutting to the approximate cost of leverage. So you can determine if a 20% fund levered, while its actual cost of leverage will be lower than a 35% levered fund, is it actually done mathematically? Like, because there's more leverage, the cost should be more, but is it pro rata more? That is something we find is important, because we think what you don't spend on leverage costs or management fees, you can pay the shareholders. So we're you need good managers, but you also need cash flow to pay dividends.
So you may have made, what's the time?
About 3 minutes, 2 minutes. Oh. Yeah, depends on the clock. They're all.
I'll let you guys answer. Do you have any questions? Otherwise, I got lots of questions.
Okay.
I can ask John this private.
Whatever you want, yeah.
Now, it's interesting here about the BDCs.
Yes.
Give me the 60-second version of what a BDC does. It's like a private equity firm, except it's dealing with debt.
Mostly debt traditionally, though there's some equity exposures in there now. And yeah, they make loans or do private venture capital like financing to smaller businesses. I believe it's $250 million. It's in the intro to the newsletter. But it's smaller companies. They have to have mostly exposure to that. And it's companies that can't get a loan at a bank. In fact, Prospect Capital, they have a crowdfunding part of their business, like Kickstarter or other, but actually Kickstarter is donation, but where they pool lenders to solve problems, and they have a part of their business that does that. I mean, so just very interesting ways to loan money to small companies, typically, like there's, again, $3.5 billion, and they'll do $20 million loans. And I was like, how do you, he goes, well, those companies that they grow will typically need more money later, and we don't do those easily, but if we see really good businesses, we'll put $20 million to something, even when their total needle is $3.5 billion, because they might end up investing $500 million over 5 years if the business takes off and have really fantastic returns. So, yeah, it's, I mean, I'm about 2 months into it, so I know a lot, but I'll know more in a month. The average, most funds yield between 8 and 12.
I think it'd be higher because of the private, the liquidity, the
some are premiums. Return. Some are premiums, so that will, but again, the premiums, the NAS only print quarterly, so you can't guarantee it's actually a current premium. But there's a good third of the funds that are at premiums over 5 or 10. They're premiums in the 10, 20s, 30s,
so
and their discounts. Then actually the yield is higher and you're only getting 12% because you're buying at a premium. And if it's growing NAV and it's performing well in investment wise, then that's why it's currently doing that. Prospect trades at a typically tight to net asset value, even though it only prints 4 times a year. Like typically a 5 premium to a 5 discount is, from our research, normal for it. It's trading, I think, right now at about a 1% premium.
We need to wrap it up. I got a lot more questions for John. I hope you enjoyed this conversation today. It's actually a fascinating little space in the market. You're competing against mom and pop, not sophisticated investment. John gets to go to work every day and compete against mom and pop and take advantage of market inefficiencies. And there's not really that many areas of the market that you can point to that said they're inefficient. And there's not many things you can look at and say, this is what the asset's worth, and we know that, and this is what it's trading at. So some really interesting opportunities. So I hope you enjoyed that. So, John, thank you so much.
Thank you.
How do you deal with the valuation uncertainty in these BDCs? They have good auditors, and you have to.
It.